You're listening to the ILFD podcast, where we take a dive into the International Literature Festival Dublin archives and share some of our favorite conversations from years past. Today, we're listening to award-winning writer Neil Gaiman, whose works include Good Omens, American Gods, Norse Mythology, and Coraline, to name but a few. He's in conversation with author and journalist Patrick Frayne from the 2018 edition of the festival.
Hello, everybody. This is an absolute joy for me to do. When I was about 18 or 19, my mind was kind of blown for good by the Sandman comics that Neil wrote back in the late 80s, They started my kind of passion for your work, but when I first read those, I kind of started getting the sense that there was another world slightly out of the view of the one I could see, and all of your work since. So you moved from Sandman, you did Black Orchid before Sandman, you did an array of amazing novels, Neverwhere, which was a TV show first, yeah. Anansi Boys, the amazing epic American Gods, which made me look at strange people in bars and wonder, were they gods? The Ocean at the End of the Lane, your kids' books like Coraline and the Graveyard
book.
Sorry,
I think you're doing really well.
Yeah, I know. Thanks, Neil. They're just amazingly kind of creepy and sweet and beautiful and. They're very enjoyable for adults, never mind kids. And most recently, the Norse Mythologies, which I think you're going to be reading from later, which I kind of read and went, these Norse stories are very Neil Gaiman-y. So we'll talk a little bit about that later. And he's also working as the showrunner on The Good Omens, the adaptation of the story he wrote with the late, brilliant Terry Pratchett. And now is being turned into a TV show. I'm going to just rattle through his career. I heard I was doing an evening with Neil Gaiman, and I was like, oh, brilliant. And then I realized, oh, there's going to be some other people here. So you're going to get to ask some questions later. For the moment, I'll probably just indulge myself and start by asking, when you were a kid, what were you like as a kid?
I was a lot like the kid in The Ocean at the End of the Lane. It's not quite a self-portrait, but it's very, very close. In that, what I loved more than anything were books. And books were just these fantastic things. Books were where you were safe. Books were where everything made sense. I was the kind of 7-year-old who alphabetized his books.
Yeah.
I was, you know, the kind of 7-year-old who would, you know, my pocket money went on books.
What were the things that were shaping your brain back then? What were the books?
The ones that really got in there and just sort of actually shaped things. C.S. Lewis, Narnia books. Absolutely loved them until I was about 11. And I love the fact that I'd managed to read the Narnia books hundreds of times. You know, literally, I'd read that sequence of 7 books over and over, completely missing the death of Aslan being and resurrection being anything like Christ on the cross. And then somewhere through a reading of The Voyage of the Dawn Treader and reading the account of Eustace Scrubb becoming a dragon, I went, hang on, this is St. Paul on the way to Damascus. Oh my God. and just sort of like this sudden moment of this isn't fair. Hang on, you're not, I thought I trusted you and I don't trust you anymore. You're allegorizing, you're cheating. And then I got very angry with the Narnia books for about another, you know, 15 odd years. And then I read them to my children and got to read them twice all the way through to kids at different ages. And I'm quite looking forward to reading them again aloud. They're fantastic books to read aloud.
I don't know if you're really astute or if I'm really stupid, but when I was in my 20s, that's the first time I realized C.S. Lewis was a Christian. So I kind of read, I loved the Narnia books, and then I was reading all this stuff about, oh, it's Christian propaganda, but I missed that. Did you want to be a writer from a young age?
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to be a writer. Being a writer was my fantasy. You know, other kids fantasized about being train drivers or astronauts or whatever. I would fantasize about, well, by the time I was about 11, I actually had this fantastic fantasy which came with detail, because I love the fact that I never actually really realized at that age that you could become an author just by sitting down and writing. But I did want to be an author, and I didn't just want to be any author. I wanted to be the person who'd written Lord of the Rings. Obviously, there was a problem with this, because Lord of the Rings had already been written. It had been written by J.R.R. Tolkien. He was alive. Back then, so there was a real problem. So what I did was travel everywhere with a very battered, at that point, coverless, three-volume in one book edition of Lord of the Rings, working on the theory that if I happened to slip into a parallel dimension, exactly like the one we all live in, except J.R.R. Tolkien had not written Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
I would have the manuscript with me. Obviously, then it got more difficult because you couldn't just send it to a publisher. I was going to have to find an adult and get them to type all 1,300 pages out for me into a typescript that I could then send to a publisher with my name on. And then, of course, I was going to have to murder the adult. Because you couldn't leave witnesses to something like that. And that was always the point where it bogged down. It was such a good plan, and then it turned into murder, and I would stop. But that, you know, that, there was that kind of idea that I really wanted. I wanted to write. But I wanted to be a writer, more even than I wanted to write to that age. I just loved the idea of being somebody who could give other people what C.S. Lewis or Tolkien or P.L. Travers or any of the other authors I loved had given me.
So after you realized the J.R.R. Tolkien parallel universe murder plot wasn't going to work, what was the first thing do you remember the first thing you ever wrote, the first bit of fiction you ever wrote?
Yeah.
Like, were you a kid?
I mean, school essays were... English essays, for me, were always a chance to create fiction, and I'd go off and... I remember, you know, I wrote a few probably half-decent short stories. By the time I was about 11 or 12, every now and then, something readable would happen. But there was no sort of reliability to it. And probably from about there... until my early 20s, mostly what I did was start things. I was very good at starting things. There were so many novels started, short stories started, things started. I have, you know, last time I was in my attic, I have boxes filled with things and pulling them out and just... you know, some of them were really interesting. Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandermeer from Neverwhere make their first appearance in something vaguely Harry Potter-like that I was writing when I was about 19.
Did you continue writing, or were you, when you were a journalist, had you kind of stopped doing fiction writing, or were you continuously working on things?
As far as I was concerned, the reason to be a journalist was to understand how publishing worked, to understand how everything in the world worked, and to subsidize the fiction.
How'd that work out?
Pretty well, actually. I mean, in, you know, sort of year one, I probably sold one short story and to Imagine magazine, maybe two short stories, and maybe made 150 quid through fiction. Year two, there was We Can Get Them For You Wholesale and another couple of things, and they were selling to places that paid, you know, 300 quid a shot. But there was always this idea that, okay, one day, it's always easier to start out in journalism, it's always easier to start out in nonfiction, but also I wanted to talk to writers, and I wanted to talk to writers and ask them the kind of questions that you don't normally get to ask writers.
Do you have any particular examples that I can ask you?
A lot of the best questions weren't actually asked during the interviews. They were the things in the pub after the interview was over, whatever. I remember something that became a kind of a guiding light for my career was something I decided to do in the first couple of years of interviewing. Because I was interviewing a lot of best-selling authors, important authors, popular authors, and I started to realize that a lot of the people I think of or thought of then as best-selling, important, would, after a couple of drinks and once the interview was over, start telling you about, you know, here's a best-selling mystery novel, novelist telling you about his fantasy novel that nobody will publish. Mm-hmm. Here's a science fiction writer telling you about his historical novel about the French Revolution or whatever that nobody will publish. And I started realizing that a lot of people were in boxes that were defined by their success, which was very limiting and frustrating for them.
So were you very aware of that when your career started to take off, that you had to break out of those boxes?
I was. I mean, it was one of those things where the great thing about being friends with writers and being friends with writers who were older than I was you could go, okay, there's a thing that you're doing. I'm not going to do that. There was something which I don't know in retrospect if I ever did anything consciously about it, but I was talking, I had dinner the other day with a very well-known writer who was incredibly happy that one of his books is now on the sort of GCSE syllabus in the UK and is thus being read by young people. And he was saying, they turn up at my signings. And he was so thrilled because his audience had been aging. And I remember how sad it was talking to authors whose work I had loved when I was 23, 24. And I would meet authors who were probably about the age that I am now, I'm 57, but their readership was older than they were. And their readership was now sort of dwindling and dying. And they were not selling in the numbers that they had been. And I remember thinking that, you know, that's something to be avoided. You do not want a world in which your readership...
The children's books are like a shrewd form of succession planning.
I don't think I was ever quite so cold and brilliant about it.
Yeah.
It was much more that I had stories to tell and I had kids who were not convinced that I did a proper job. So you can... It's the best way of convincing your children... You actually do a proper job is by going, look, here's this thing that I do that you'll like.
Do you treat when you start writing, say something like Caroline, would you have known when you started writing that this one is a children's book? Or is that something that develops over the course of
thought Caroline was a children's book.
Okay.
I was probably, when I was writing it, alone in this belief, apart from my kids, who I would try it out on. I remember I had a wonderful editor named Richard Evans, who'd been our editor at Golanx on Good Omens. He's now dead. And And I remember showing him the first third of Coraline, and in about 1991, and Richard saying, "Well, it's brilliant. I think it's the best thing you've written. It's unpublishable." And I'm like, "Why is it unpublishable?" He said, "Well, it's a horror story for children.
Yeah.
They're unpublishable, and you seem to be aiming this at children and adults, and there's no way that we could hit both audiences."
So crossing it, so when you started with comics, why did comics, I know you were a fan of comics when you were a kid, but why in your 20s did you go, okay, I'm going to try comics now? What is it about them as a medium? What's different about them as a medium? What do they do that nothing else can do?
Oh, there's that last question is a glorious one. My favorite thing that comics can do that nothing else can do is silent panels. Okay. Nothing else can do a silent panel. You can have a panel which is just a face. You know, your character's talking and then they stop. And then you can carry on. And you can't do that in a novel, because in order to do that in a novel, you have to use words. Here, you can actually just make something happen and suddenly it's wordless just for a moment. Whenever I write novels or fiction, I miss silent panels. I'd loved comics. I loved particularly American comics. The ones that came over to the UK as ballast. And particularly the weird ones. You know, I loved Swamp Thing, I loved House of Mystery, I loved all of those. I liked superhero comics, but I didn't love them because they always felt vaguely predictable. Mm-hmm. You were fairly sure that Superman would win. Or Batman would win. You know, and if they lost this time, they'd win in the next episode, because that's how it worked. Whereas, you know, in the tales of the unexpected or whatever, lots of people die, and you're never quite sure who's going to make it to the end of the story, which was fun. I loved comics. I mean, as far as I was concerned, comics were a legitimate medium. When I was about 16, they cut the number of pages in comics, increased the prices, and I kind of stopped reading American comics, except for Will Eisner's Spirit. They were still being reprinted, and I would go up to Dark They Were and Golden-Eyed in Berwick Street and buy them and bring them home. And just loved comics, but had this idea of comics in my head and didn't see that thing being manifested in the world. And then I was about 22, and I picked up an Alan Moore Swamp Thing on Victoria Station, just out of sort of nostalgia.
Swamp Thing. The audience.
Exactly. And I read it, and I wish I could say, and I bought it, and it was my first comic. But I didn't actually put it back down, having read it all the way through, and having gone, this is really good. But I'd sort of bumped into that weird thing of, well, it's really good, but I don't think comics are any good right now, and I'm not sure what I think of this. So I put it back down. And then 3 weeks later, I'm on Victoria Station. They've got another one, and I read that. It's like, this really is really good. And I don't think I bought that one. And then the month after, I was like, I'm doomed. Yes. And suddenly I was hooked.
And you asked Alan Moore how to do scripts, didn't you?
I did. I was completely fascinated by just the idea of how do you write a comic? I didn't know. I know what a movie script looks like. You could go down to any bookshop and buy film scripts, and you know what they look like. And I know what plays, how you write a play. But I didn't know how do you do that thing of getting something out of your head and into an artist's head? And so I met Alan at a small convention in the UK in about 1985. And I said, okay, show me how you write a comic. And he pulled out a notebook and just sort of went page one, panel one, and just showed me how you do everything. You know, you describe things. Here's how you say who's talking. If you want a special effect noise, you go FX, bang, you know, that kind of thing. Thinks, caption. I was like, oh, okay. I wrote one and gave it to him, and he said, yeah, it's pretty good. It gets a bit weird at the end. And I wrote another one and gave it to him, and he said, yeah, that's really good. And that was where I began.
How did, like, Sandman is an incredible phenomenon. Like, how did that happen? How did DC allow you to do Sandman? Like, it was basically meant to be initially a kind of reinvigoration of an old character, at least some of an old mythology. But it's such an anomaly. Or what was it at the time? Were they doing other things like that I don't... I missed?
No. not really. I mean, Sandman was... I think I was mostly allowed to do Sandman because nobody except me had any idea what I was doing. But whatever it was, it seemed to be selling okay. So nobody was doing any kind of suggesting or leaning on me or anything. It was just like, well, we don't know what he's doing, but people are buying it. So, okay. The hardest thing with Sandman was persuading them that when I was done with it, it would stop. Mm-hmm. And that took about 3-4 years from the very first time, maybe even more, I said to them, by the way, you know, when I finish, I want Sandman to stop. And the first time I explained that, it was explained to me that, no. Obviously, the whole point of comics is a new writer will come in and, you know, Batman didn't stop, and Superman didn't stop, and The Flash didn't stop, and Sandman won't stop.
So there'd be a version of Sandman in a muscle suit now running around.
He would be driving around in a sand car. Yeah. With his, you know, sand costume. You know, I think I was really lucky. It was a process. Sandman for me was a process of discovery. Yeah. You know, those first 8 issues, which were basically, they were all plotted driving around Ireland, driving from starting in Dublin and just sort of going around. And I got my first check-in from Black Orchid somewhere in about 87, I guess. And I, you know, it's like never actually had disposable money before. Yes. So we went on holiday, me and my wife, and we were driving around. And I just remember mostly what I was doing during the driving was just putting those first 8 issues together in my head, and couldn't wait to stop for the night, so I'd write it all down.
I could take a detour now and just keep asking questions about Sandman. Like, one of the things that blew my mind when I was a kid was just seeing a few panels that were set in Dublin in Brief Lives, which you just didn't see in American comics ever.
And I also like the fact that the Dublin it was set in was Dublin. I used to get frustrated whenever DC or Marvel comics would set things in London, which is a tiny little village with thatched roofs everywhere and these enormous red buses that dwarf the houses and trundle through, and occasionally sort of, you know, gangs of mods and rockers on motorbikes would battle on Tower Bridge.
Sounds accurate.
And so there was always that thing of just trying to make places.
Do you understand why, like, it was so big for fans? Like, the other interesting thing about Sandman that seems way ahead of its time now is that there was loads of female characters, people of color, gay characters, trans characters. Would you have considered American comics to have been a very conservative place at the time? Like, were you aware that that was very out of the ordinary?
I was incredibly lucky. I worked with Alan Moore, you know, met Alan, hung around with Alan, talked with Alan. Alan politically is is a, you know, feminist anarchist who got me doing things like, you know, Artists Against Rampant Government Homophobia, doing comics for them and stuff. So it was very much a... It didn't seem odd to me to put that kind of stuff into comics. What mostly seemed odd to me was that when Sandman was coming out, I was being consistently criticized for not being political and for Sandman not being political. And because I didn't have anybody going, Margaret Thatcher eats babies and stuff. And from my perspective...
It's good material.
You know, she probably did, but I was much more interested in putting, you know, people I knew, putting things that I thought, putting that kind of stuff in. So I was very, you know, I loved the fact that I was getting to write a feminist comic. I thought it was great. I loved the fact that, you know, I had a lot of trans friends. I put trans characters in. You know, could I have done it better? Yes, I'm sure I could have done, but at least here were trans characters in mainstream American comics, and there hadn't been any before. All of that kind of stuff, as far as I was concerned, was good and big, important, and political, but also it was all in service of the story, which always seemed to me like the most important thing.
And it brought other readers in. So there was over 50% of the Sandman readers were women, right?
Which is really... Not in the beginning. It was just your normal comic shop audience who all had penises. And then about 6 months in, you'd start spotting the occasional person without a penis. And what I think was happening was that particularly Sandman was spread sexually. Yeah. You would get males who read Sandman would say to their girlfriends, you're always, you know, giving me shit for reading comics. Here, read this. Yeah. And then when they broke up, the girlfriend would take the Sandmans and spread them. And it was lovely. I would get, you know, I would go to the San Diego Comic Convention and get very large men in very sweaty T-shirts coming up and pumping my hand and saying, dude, I got to thank you. You brought women into my store. And the urge to say, if you just sweep up, they'll come back.
Sandman helped me meet my wife. I was in... I was in Trinity College, and my wife noticed me. She's probably here somewhere. But she said she first noticed that I was in any way interesting because I had Sandman comics on my desk. So thank you, Neil.
You are very welcome, Patrick. I love stories like that. And I love the fact that, you know, by the end, you know, Sandman got to bring an audience who didn't know that they liked comics to comics, and they stayed. And that felt huge and important.
When you finished Sandman, that must have been a relentless schedule for 7-8 years. Were you relieved it was over? Did you realize that it was one complete body of work that you just done? Or
no, I knew that, but I also knew that I had to stop for my sanity. I had this rule, which was I could never get to the point ever in my life where I would look at a mirror in the morning and go, oh God, I got to write Sandman. It always had to be, I always had to be excited, it always had to be good. And I never got to the point where it was going to feel like work. But I could see that was about a year across over the horizon. And if it didn't end where it ended, it would start to become a job. And I figured that the joy was palpable. And the lovely thing about that is it means that I can come back. And it means that I got to come back and do Dream Hunters. It meant I got to come back and do Endless Nights. And, you know, my favorite was coming back and doing Sandman Overture. And just doing this thing where it was like, okay, so all of these little things, that there are things that I built into Sandman while I was writing it where I knew more than I told. And here, I will do a story and I will tell those things. And then people will go, oh my gosh, really? And then they'll start at the beginning again. And now it'll be a slightly different story.
As a reader, Sandman, American Gods, like nearly all your work feels like these kind of complete universes you've built. Does it feel like that to you as a writer? Does it feel like I'm going back into the Sandman universe now? Or
kind of. I mean, they all feel like they sort of share, they share a sort of, you know, car park around the back.
Yeah.
They're all different universes, but they all kind of join up and you could, you can cross over.
Did you, all your stuff is like mythic and fantastical, and what's important about that form of creativity? Like, as opposed to, you never went, I've got to write about a middle-aged writer having a nervous breakdown at a dinner party.
Well, I kind of did that once with Signal to Noise, which was absolutely a delight. That was a film director in late middle age dying of cancer, making his last film in his head before he died. And part of the joy of that was going, yeah, I can do this too. Let's go and do one of these. But mostly, I like the fact that when I sit down to create, I am God. Nobody gets to tell me what to do. Nobody gets to tell me what the rules are. It's my world. And so I you know, sort of get to go in there and play. And if I want things mythic, I can take them mythic. If I want them silly, like Fortunately the Milk, I can go silly. If I want to do something like Anansi Boys, which is a giant sort of comedy of manners and embarrassment, I'm allowed to do that. If I want to go horror, I can go horror. I like, mostly what I like is being allowed to do whatever the next thing is.
What do you think readers get from the fantastical, though? Because, I mean, I've always been a fan of, like, horror and sci-fi and fantasy, and the, like, it always feels to me like it's like a weird replacement for religion or something, that it's like, it creates this illusion. When I read one of your novels and then I look at the world, I go, okay, there could be something else going on behind it, which is this.
I like the idea of imbuing the world with a little more magic than perhaps it had before people read things. I like the idea of leaving the place more interesting. You know, I'm not going to be around forever. If I've left an odder, more interesting London behind me, I will be happy. If I love the way that the ocean at the end of the lane is sort of my childhood story. You know, I wrote it for Amanda, my wife, to go, this is for you. Here is a way of looking at my childhood because you weren't there. But by the same token, I love the fact that people come up to me and say, how did you write my childhood? And my childhood was nothing like that. But Ocean at the End of the Lane is my childhood too. It's like, yeah, good. I like being able to do that. But normally what I start with is a point of obsession. You know, it's something that I cannot get out of my head. And the easiest way and the most practical way to get it out of my head is to get it down on paper.
Do you think a lot about where stories come from? Because right through the comics and the books, like in Norse mythology, there's the story of where poetry comes from. It comes from a god who is killed and his blood is
turned into mead. Evil dwarves.
Then Odin turns into a bird and then spits it back into a cauldron. And if I drink that,
yep,
I can write a cool
story. That gives you the mead of poetry.
I presume that's
also the stuff that comes out of his ass.
Which is the
Do not drink that. That is bad poetry.
So
you will find alternate versions. There are much politer versions of the bad poetry. In one, it's the stuff that drips off his beak. But then you sort of look, you read the original, and you go, no, that's not what they're saying.
Because in Sandman as well, there's a character who captures one of the muses, and then he's got covered, like there's loads of stories, and it's almost killing him. Are you filled with stories? Are they easy? Do they come easy?
They used to come easier. You know, I definitely look back at me, aged about 30, as a sort of absolute golden period where it's like, yes, I could just, they were all there and they were all ready, and I could do something like write a story like Chivalry or A Dream of a Thousand Cats in a weekend, and it was easy and wonderful. These days, not so much. I mean, there's still lots of stories, and there's still, you know, dozens of stories circling to come into land, like some kind of, you know, bizarre air traffic control. There's one, you know, there's a book about frogs in Central Park that I've got about two chapters into, and I know how it goes, and I just need to get it down. And there's a lot of, and there's the novel that I'm 97 pages into right now and put on hold while I'm doing the Good Omen stuff. And I'm probably going to get back to, I think, within about a month, which makes me ridiculously happy. But I definitely don't have that amazing, glorious fecundity of ideas that I had at that point. But I also feel now like I probably deal better with the ideas that I do have than I did back then. Because back then I was just like, whee! And now I'm like, okay, I am old, experienced, and evil. I can do this and make people cry. You know, and that kind of thing, which I wouldn't necessarily have done back then.
Will you read us a story, Leo?
I will. Ah, so, Amanda, my wife, who is down there somewhere, said to me, as she came and said hello backstage, and she said, given what's going on in Ireland right now, given the wonderfulness, you should read something that's sort of feminist. I'm like, and I thought, yes, she's right. And then I thought, it's Norse mythology. I have no doubt there were fantastic women stories in here, but they didn't get written down. We know all of these wonderful goddesses existed. We have their names. But we don't know a lot about them. So I'm going to read the nearest thing. I'll head over here if we can have... Can we have a light over here on the podium? Is that possible? Am I going to wind up doing this in the dark? Dark is good. Thank you. So I'm going to do a story that isn't, but kind of is. It's called Freya's Unusual Wedding. Thor, god of thunder, mightiest of all the Aesir, the strongest, the bravest, the most valiant in battle, was not entirely awake yet, but he had the feeling that something was wrong. He reached out a hand for his hammer, which he always kept within reach while he slept. He fumbled around with his eyes closed. He groped about, reaching for the comfortable and familiar shaft of his hammer. No hammer. Thor opened his eyes. He sat up. He stood up. He walked around the room. There was no hammer anywhere. His hammer was gone. Thor's hammer was called Mjolnir. It had been made for Thor by the dwarfs Brokk and Eitri. It was one of the treasures of the gods. If Thor hit anything with it, that thing would be destroyed. If he threw the hammer at something, the hammer would never miss its target, and would always fly back through the air and return to his hand. He could shrink the hammer down and hide it inside his shirt, and he could make it grow again. It was a perfect hammer in all things except one. It was slightly too short in the handle, which meant that Thor had to swing it one-handed.
The hammer kept the gods of Asgard safe from all the dangers that menaced them and the world. Frost giants and ogres, trolls and monsters of every kind, all were frightened of Thor's hammer. Thor loved his hammer. And his hammer simply was not there. There were things Thor did when something went wrong. The first thing he did was ask himself if what had happened was Loki's fault. Thor pondered. He did not believe that even Loki would have dared to steal his hammer. So he did the next thing he did when something went wrong, and he went to ask Loki for advice. Loki was crafty. Loki would tell him what to do. "Don't tell anyone," said Thor to Loki, "but the hammer of the gods has been stolen." "That," said Loki, making a face, "is not good news. Let me see what I can find out." Loki went to Freya's hall. Freya was the most beautiful of all the gods. Her golden hair tumbled about her shoulders, and it glinted in the morning light. Freya's two cats prowled the room, eager to pull her chariot. Around her neck, as golden and shining as her hair, glittered the necklace of the Brisings, made for Freya by dwarfs far underground. "I'd like to borrow your feathered cloak," said Loki, "the one that lets you fly." "Absolutely not," said Freya. "That cloak is the most valuable thing I possess. It's more valuable than gold. I'm not having you wearing it and going around and making mischief." "Thor's hammer's been stolen," said Loki. "I need to find it." "I'll get you the cloak," said Freya. Loki put on the feathered cloak, and he took to the air in falcon shape. He flew beyond Asgard. He flew deep into the land of the giants, looking for something unusual. Beneath him, Loki saw a huge grave mound, and sitting on it, plaiting a dog collar, was the hugest, ugliest ogre of a giant he had ever seen. When the ogre saw Loki in falcon shape, he grinned a sharp-toothed grin and waved. "What's up with the Aesir, Loki? What's the news from the elves, and why have you come alone into the land of the giants?" Loki landed beside the ogre. "There's nothing but bad news from Asgard and nothing but bad news from the elves." "Really?" said the ogre, and he chuckled to himself as if he were extremely pleased with something he'd done and thought himself remarkably clever. Loki recognized that sort of chuckle. Sometimes he did it himself. "Thor's hammer is missing," said Loki. "Would you know anything about that?" The ogre scratched his armpit, and he chuckled once more. "I might," he admitted. Then he said, "How's Freya? Is she as beautiful as they say?" "If you like that sort of thing," said Loki. "Oh, I do," said the ogre. "I do." There was another uncomfortable silence. The ogre put the dog collar down on a pile of dog collars and began to plait another. "I have Thor's hammer," the ogre told Loki. "I've hidden it so deep beneath the earth that nobody could ever find it, not even Odin. I'm the only one who could bring it up again, and I will return it to Thor if you bring me what I want." "I can ransom the hammer," said Loki. "I can bring you gold and amber. I can bring you treasures beyond counting." "Don't want them," said the ogre. "I want to marry Freya." "Bring her here in 8 days from now. I'll return the hammer of the gods as a bride gift on Freya's wedding night." "Who are you?" asked Loki. The ogre grinned and showed his crooked teeth. "Why, Loki, son of Laufey, I am Thrym, lord of the ogres." "I have no doubt that we can come to an arrangement, great Thrym," said Loki. He drew Freya's feathered cloak around him, then stretched his arms and took to the skies. Beneath Loki, the world seemed very small. He looked down at the trees and the mountains, tiny as children's playthings, and the problems of the gods seemed a small thing also. Thor was waiting for him in the court of the gods, and before Loki had even landed, he found himself seized by Thor's huge hands.
"Well, you know something. I can see it in your face. Tell me whatever you know and tell it now. I don't trust you, Loki, and I want to know what you know right this moment before you've had a chance to plot and to plan."
Loki, who plotted and planned as easily as other folk breathed in and out, smiled at Thor's anger and innocence. "Your hammer has been stolen by Thrym, lord of all the ogres," he said. "I have persuaded him to return it to you, but he demands a price."
"Fair enough," said Thor. "What's the price?"
"Freya's hand in marriage."
"He just wants her hand?"
asked Thor, hopefully. She had two hands, after all, and might be persuaded to give up one of them without too much of an argument. Tyr had, after all. "All of her," said Loki. "He wants to marry her."
"Oh," said Thor. "She won't like that. Well, you can tell her the news. You're better at persuading people to do things than I am when I'm not holding my hammer."
They went together to Freya's court once more. "Here's your feathered cloak," said Loki. "Thank you," said Freya. "Did you find out who stole Thor's hammer?" "Thrym, lord of the ogres. I've heard of him, a nasty piece of work. What does he want for it?" "You," said Loki. "He wants to marry you." Freya nodded. Thor was pleased that she seemed to have accepted the idea so easily.
"Put on your bridal crown, Freya, and pack your things," he said. "You and Loki are going to the land of the giants. We need to get you married off to Thrym before he changes his mind. I want my hammer back."
Freya did not say anything. Thor noticed that the ground was shaking, as were the walls. Freya's cats mewed and hissed, and they fled beneath a chest of furs and would not come out. Freya's hands were squeezed into tight fists. The necklace of the Brisings tumbled from her neck to the floor. She did not appear to notice. She was staring at Thor and Loki as if they were the lowest, most unpleasant vermin she had ever seen. Thor was almost relieved when Freya began to speak. "What kind of person do you think I am?" she asked very quietly. "Do you think I'm that foolish, that disposable? That I'm someone who would actually marry an ogre just to get you out of trouble? If you two think that I'm going to the land of the giants, that I'll put on a bridal crown and veil and submit to the touch and the lust of that ogre, that I'd marry him, well..." She stopped talking. The walls shuddered once again, and Thor feared the entire building would fall upon them. "Get out," said Freya. "What kind of woman do you think I am?"
"But my hammer,"
said Thor. "Shut up, Thor," said Loki. Thor shut up. They left.
"She's very beautiful when she's angry," said Thor. "You can see why the ogre wants to marry her."
"Shut up, Thor," said Loki again. They called a gathering of all the gods in the great hall. Every god and goddess was there, except Freya, who declined to leave her house. All day they talked, debated, and argued. There was no question that they needed to get Mjolnir back, but how? Each god and goddess made a suggestion, and each suggestion was shot down by Loki. In the end, only one god had not spoken, Heimdall, the far-seeing, who watches over the world. Not one thing happens that Heimdall does not see, and sometimes he sees events that have yet to occur in the world. "Well," said Loki, "what about you, Heimdall? Do you have any suggestions?"
"I do," said Heimdall, "but you won't like it."
Thor banged his fist down upon the table.
"It does not matter whether or not we like it," he said. "We are gods. There is nothing that any of us gathered here would not do to get back Mjolnir, the hammer of the gods. Tell us your idea, and if it is a good idea, we will like it."
"You won't like it," said Heimdall.
"We will like it," said Thor.
"Well," said Heimdall, "I think we should dress Thor as a bride. Have him put on the necklace of the Brisings, have him wear a bridal crown, stuff his dress so he looks like a woman, veil his face. We'll have him wear keys that jingle as women do, drape him with jewels."
"I don't like it," said Thor. "People will think, well, for a start, they'll think I dress up in women's clothes. absolutely out of the question. I don't like it. I'm definitely not going to be wearing a bridal veil. None of us like this idea, do we? Terrible, terrible idea. I've got a beard. I can't shave off my beard. Shut up, Thor, said Loki, son of Laufey. It's an excellent idea. If you don't want the giants to invade Asgard, you will put on a wedding veil which will hide your face and your beard. Odin, the All Highest, said, it is indeed an excellent idea. Well done, Heimdall. We need the hammer back, and this is the best way. Goddesses, prepare Thor for his wedding night. The goddesses brought him things to wear. Frigg and Fulla, Sif, Idun, and the rest, even Skathi, Freya's stepmother, came and helped to prepare him. They dressed him in the finest clothes, the kind a highborn goddess would wear to her wedding. Frigg went to see Freya and came back with the necklace of the Brisings, and she hung it about Thor's neck. Sif, Thor's wife, hung her keys at Thor's side. Idun brought all her jewels, which she draped about Thor so he glittered and gleamed in the candlelight, and she brought 100 rings of red gold and white gold to go on Thor's fingers. They covered his face with a veil so that only his eyes could be seen, and Var, the goddess of marriage, placed a shining headdress upon Thor's head, a bridal crown high and wide and beautiful. I'm not sure about the eyes, Var said. They don't look very feminine.
I should hope not, muttered Thor.
Var looked at Thor. If I pull down the headdress, it will hide them, but he still has to be able to see. Do your best, said Loki, and then he said, I'll be your maidservant and go with you to the land of the giants. Loki shifted his shape, and now he was, in voice and in appearance, a beautiful young serving woman. There, how do I look? Thor muttered something under his breath, but it might have been a good thing that nobody could hear it. Loki and Thor clambered into Thor's chariot, and the goats who pulled it, Snarler and Grinder, leapt into the skies, eager to be off. Mountains broke in half as they passed, and the earth burst into flame beneath them.
I have a bad feeling about this, said Thor.
Don't speak, said Loki in the form of a maiden. Let me do all the talking. Can you remember that? If you speak, you may ruin everything. Thor grunted. They landed in the courtyard. Giant-sized jet-black oxen stood impassively. Each beast was larger than a house. The tips of their horns were capped with gold, and the courtyard stank with the sharp smell of their dung. A booming voice could be heard from inside the huge, high hall. Move it, you fools! Spread clean straw on the benches! What do you think you're doing? Well, pick it up or cover it with straw. Don't just leave it there to rot. This is Freya, the most beautiful creature in existence, Njord's daughter, who comes to us. She won't want to see something like that. There was a path made of fresh straw through the courtyard, and after leaving their chariot, the disguised Thor and the serving maiden, who was Loki, walked across the straw, lifting their skirts so they didn't drag in the muck. A giant woman was waiting for them. She introduced herself as Thrym's sister, and she reached down and pinched Loki's pretty cheek between her fingertips, and she prodded Thor with one sharp fingernail. So this is the most beautiful woman in the world. Doesn't look much to me. And when she picked up her skirts, it seemed to me that her ankles were as thick as small tree trunks. A trick of the light. She is the most beautiful of all the gods, said the maiden who was Loki smoothly. When her veil comes off, I promise you will be struck down by her beauty. Now, where is her groom? Where is the wedding feast? She is so eager for this. I have barely been able to restrain her. The sun was setting as they were led into the great hall for the wedding feast.
What if he wants me to sit next to him? Whispered Thor to Loki.
You have to sit next to him. That's where the bride sits.
But he might try and put his hand on my leg, Thor whispered urgently.
I'll sit between you, said Loki. I'll tell him it's our custom. Thrym sat at the head of the table, and Loki sat next to him with Thor at the next seat on the bench.
Thrym clapped his hands and giant serving men came in. They carried 5 whole roast oxen, enough to feed the giants. They brought in 20 whole baked salmon, each fish the size of a 10-year-old boy. Also, they carried in dozens of trays of little pastries and fancies intended for the women. They were followed by 5 more serving men, each one carrying a whole cask of mead, a barrel huge enough that each giant struggled beneath the weight of it. "This meal is for the beautiful Freya," said Thrym, and he might have said something else, but Thor had already started to eat and to drink, and it would have been rude for Thrym to have talked while the bride-to-be was eating. A tray of pastries for the womenfolk was placed in front of Loki and Thor. Loki carefully picked out the smallest pastry. Thor just as carefully swept the rest of the pastries up, and they vanished to the sound of munching under the veil. The other women, who had been looking at the pastries hungrily, glared, disappointed, at the beautiful Freya. But the beautiful Freya had not even begun to eat. Thor ate a whole ox all by himself. He ate 7 entire salmon, leaving nothing but the bones. Each time a tray of pastries was brought to him, he devoured all the fancies and pastries on it, leaving all the other women hungry. Sometimes Loki would kick him under the table, but Thor ignored every kick and just kept eating. Thrym tapped Loki on the shoulder. "Excuse me," he said, "but the lovely Freya has just polished off her 3rd cask of mead." "I'm sure she has," said the maiden who was Loki. "Amazing. I've never seen any woman eat so ravenously, never seen any woman eat so much or drink so much mead." "There is," said Loki, "an obvious explanation." He took a deep breath and watched Thor inhale another whole salmon and pull a salmon skeleton out from under his veil. It was like watching a magic trick. He wondered what the obvious explanation was. "That makes 8 salmon she's eaten," said Thrym. 8 days and 8 nights," said Loki suddenly. "She hasn't eaten for 8 days and 8 nights. She was so keen to come to the land of the giants and make love to her new husband. Now she's in your presence, she's finally eating again." And the maiden turned to Thor. "It's so good to see you eating again, my dear," she said. Thor glared at Loki from beneath the veil. "I should kiss her," said Thrym. "I wouldn't advise it, not yet," said Loki, but Thrym had already leaned over and was making kissing noises. With one huge hand, he reached for Thor's veil. The maiden who was Loki put out her arm to stop him, but it was too late. Thrym had already stopped making kissing noises and had sprung back, shaken. Thrym tapped the maiden who was Loki on the shoulder. "Can I talk with you?" he said. "Of course." They got up and walked across the hall. "Why are Freya's eyes so terrifying?" asked Thrym. "It seemed as if there was a fire burning inside them. Those weren't the eyes of a beautiful woman." "Of course not," said the maiden who was Loki smoothly. "You wouldn't expect them to be. She hasn't slept for 8 days and 8 nights, mighty Thrym. She was so consumed by love for you that she dared not sleep. She was so mad to taste your love. She's burning up inside for you. That's what you're seeing in those eyes, burning passion." "Oh," said Thrym. "I see." He smiled and licked his lips with a tongue bigger than a human pillow. "Well then." They walked back to the table. Thrym's sister had sat down in Loki's seat beside Thor and was tapping her fingernails on Thor's hand. "If you know what's good for you, you'll give me your rings," she was saying. "All your pretty golden rings. You'll be a stranger in this castle. You'll need someone looking out for you, otherwise things are going to get pretty nasty so far from home. You've got so many rings. Give me some as a bridal gift. So pretty they are, all red and gold." "Isn't it time for the wedding?" asked Loki. "It is," said Thrym. He boomed at the top of his voice. "Bring in the hammer to sanctify the bride. I want to see Mjolnir placed on the beautiful Freya's lap. Let Var, the goddess of pledges between men and women, bless and consecrate our love." It took four giants to carry Thor's hammer. They brought it in from deep inside the hall. It glinted dully in the firelight. With difficulty, they placed it on Thor's lap. "Now," said Thrym, "now let me hear your beautiful voice. My love, my dove, my sweetness. Tell me that you love me. Tell me that you will be my bride. Tell me that you pledge yourself to me as women have pledged themselves to men and men to women since the beginning of time. What do you say?" Thor held the shaft of his hammer with a hand that was covered with golden rings. He squeezed it reassuringly. It felt familiar and comfortable in his hand. He started laughing, then a deep, booming laugh.
"What I say," said Thor, in a voice like thunder, "is that you should not have taken my hammer."
He hit Thrym with his hammer only once, but once was all it took. The ogre fell to the straw-covered floor and did not rise again. All the giants and ogres fell beneath Thor's hammer, the guests at the wedding that was never to be, even Thrym's sister, who received a bridal gift she had not been expecting. And when the hall was silent, Thor called,
"Loki!"
Loki climbed out from under the table in his original shape and surveyed the carnage. "Well," he said, "you appear to have dealt with the problem." Thor was already taking off his women's skirts with relief. He stood there wearing nothing but a shirt in a room filled with dead giants.
"There, that wasn't as bad as I'd feared," he said cheerfully. "I've got my hammer back and I had a good dinner. Let's go home."
So why Norse mythology? Like, your Loki, Thor, and Odin have turned up in your works several times in the past.
Why? Because I was asked.
Okay.
And by a lady from Norton's, an editor at Norton's, who took me out to lunch and said, "Will you retell them?" And I said, "Let me think about it." And it took me about a year before I said, "Yes, I will." And it took me about another two or three years of going back and rereading the sagas, rereading the prose Edda and the poetic Edda, and trying to figure out what the voice was. I knew if I had a voice to tell them in, that was that I could do it. And that one that I just read was the first one that I actually attempted. In about 2013, I sort of rolled up my sleeves and went, "Okay, I'm going to try one." And it was so much fun because it is, you know, actually ridiculously accurate. It's based on a poem called "The Lay of Thrym," and Thrym's poem. And it's, you know, I didn't really make very much up. I make up color and things, but so much of it is just the voice and the way that it's told. And that, for me, was the joy. And then I did. It sort of became like my knitting. You know, if you have any relations who knit, whenever they're between things, they'll take knitting out and do a little knitting and then put it away again. And so I would write a story just between things. I'd write an episode of Good Omens, and then I'd write a Norse myth. And I'd go back and do something else, and I'd come back and do a Norse myth.
Do you see, when you're picturing these characters and you're like, do you feel like it's the same Odin that's turned up in your work before? Do you see this continuity? You're the same Thor?
They're all members of the same family. Yeah. But I don't quite feel, you know, the Loki that I wrote in there isn't quite the Loki who turns up in Sandman. On the other hand, I think it's probably fair to say that the Odin, Loki, and Thor in Norse mythology are probably the same ones that show up in a book called Odd and the Frost Giants. And probably the Freya, too. In retrospect, that was my first sort of outing
Is mythology generally important to you? Because there's a mythic kind of quality in loads of your work, and obviously you draw on myths in American Gods, and you draw on myths in Anansi Boys. And
I love myths. Myths for me, you know, there are things that I always figure over and over again. I go, well, I finally got that out of my system. You know, myths is always one of them. Angels is another. And then there comes a point, you know, 3 years later, 5 years later, 10 years later, when I'm writing something, it's like, oh, no, it's not out of my system yet. And I go in and dive into myth. But there is something magical and true about myths. They feel, the good ones feel somehow right. They feel like stories that we know already, even if it's the first time we're encountering them. It's like they, you know, at least in my head, they're all stories that kind of started out as sacred mysteries. They started out as holy texts and as holy stories, and then they got the edges rubbed off them and hadn't quite yet become fairy tales and hadn't become nursery tales. But in that sort of intervening time, they get mythic.
You touched on something there about being asked to do something, and so with Sandman, and with, I was reading one of your books of short stories, I think it was in Fragile Things, you give the origin of all the stories at the start, and like loads of things you were asked to do, like somebody goes, I'm doing this collection about this thing. Do you like being given like a structure and told, write something in this?
Or? Yeah, it's always a lovely feeling to just, you know, it's that point where somebody says, do me a story about teapots. And you go, I have no stories about you. Oh, that would be a good story about a teapot. And you know, and sometimes it's very unlikely. You know, probably, you know, there is certainly a case for a short story of mine called A Study in Emerald as being my best short story. At least it's the only story I've ever written that won the Hugo Award, which is, you know, something. And that began life, as far as I was concerned, in the single most unpromising request for a story I've ever had, which was a magazine, an anthology, a short story anthology being edited by a friend to whom I couldn't really legitimately say no, saying, I'm doing an anthology of Sherlock Holmes meets H.P. Lovecraft stories. Will you do one? And it's like, that, as unpromising beginnings go, Holmes has to be about the rational, and Lovecraft has to be about the irrational, and you really don't want Holmes pulling out his magnifying glass and going, this is the mark of a Shoggoth, or whatever. And I chewed it over and thought about it, and then had an idea of a way that I could do it that would still allow Holmes to be utterly rational, and created a great detective, and then just sort of played with it a bit. And when I finished it, I read over what I'd written and went, oh, you're really, really good.
And,
that sort of knowledge, you know, and sometimes you don't get that. Sometimes somebody says, do the teapot story, and you go, okay, and you hand it over. And going, yeah, best I could do. it's a story about it. It does have a teapot in.
I want to hear the teapot story now. I want you to go write the teapot story. With Good Omens, like, which is an amazing book written 30 years ago, longer?
We started writing it. I wrote the first 5,000 words of Good Omens in about probably 87, maybe 88. And then stopped when Sandman sort of took over. I was writing Sandman and Books of Magic at the same time and stopped. And then got a phone call from Terry Pratchett, who I'd sent Good Omens to, just saying, yeah, that thing, I know what happens next. Do you want to sell me the idea, or do you want to do it together? And I said, well, let's do it together, because I'm not stupid. And you know, we did it together, and it was wonderful. But it's really been strange for me going back and doing what's essentially become the television draft. And it's even stranger now that we're in the edit.
Because you're the showrunner. Like, loads of your stuff has been adapted before, but you're in the driver's seat.
Yes, everything else pretty much of mine that's ever been done, somebody else or a bunch of somebody else has got to make all of the important decisions. And sometimes it's turned out well, and sometimes it has not turned out so well.
Can you name those two things?
Well, you know, I think Coraline is a glorious adaptation. Yeah. Henry Selick's adaptation of Coraline is great. I love The Doctor's Wife. Yeah. What's fun for me in Good Omens, though, is nobody else. And I got to make the casting decisions. I got to make... There would be times when producers would come to me and go, you have to cut this bit because it's expensive. And I would go, yeah, but if I cut that bit, then it actually stops making sense. And having experienced a little bit too much of that on my last Doctor Who episode, where I wrote a script that made sense, that the episode as shot does not, is not my fault. But it was very educational that these things can happen, that the art department can come in and rewrite something, that scenes that made something work can just vanish because they cost too much, and then people are left going, "Well, that, why did they do that?" And you go, "It made sense in my draft." So what has been lovely is just going, "Okay, no, this is my thing," and my job is to make something that Terry would have liked. It's incredibly simple, you know. It was the last thing he asked me to do before he died. It was basically the only thing he's ever really asked me to do was, you know, could you make this? We couldn't find a writer. We talked to a lot of big, important, fancy writers, and they all said, this is too big and too weird. Mm-hmm. And so Terry said, you have to do it. And I said, okay. And then he died, making it sort of the kind of thing I couldn't now go back on.
Because you'd be a monster.
I could not look at myself in the mirror in the morning if I did. So I've been making it. I'm really proud of it. And I'm really, you know, there are things where I cannot wait for people to see Michael Sheen and David Tennant as Crowley and Aziraphale. David Tennant's amazing as Crowley. Michael Sheen as Aziraphale is just this revelation. Miranda Richardson as Madame Tracy is glorious. Michael McKean as Shadwell. You know, you've just got this amazing, lovely cast. And then you've got people, and the world is filled with weird Good Omens fans. Once it started, any of them who act started going, can I be in it? So, you know, I get these people like Nick Offerman in tiny cameos. And he is probably, you know, and I'm going, that is Nick Offerman. He is one of the funniest people on the face of the planet. And he did it for scale because he wanted to be in it. And we were out of money at that point. It's like, will you be the American ambassador? He's like, yep. I said, we can't really pay you. No, I'm in. Thank you. And
I'm going to pass you over to these people now in a minute, these fans out here.
And let us do
one of the questions I was going to end with was on something, going back to something like Good Omens or going back to Sandman or anything. Is it terrifying, these people who've all read the previous stuff and have ideas of what you should do?
No.
No?
It never is. It ought to be. It would be if I didn't have an idea. You know, the idea, people say to me all the time, please, will you do Coraline 2? And the answer is no, because I have no idea what Coraline 2 would be. The only rule for me of Coraline 2 is it would have to be as good or better than Coraline, and I don't have a story in my head for Coraline that is better than the one that I did. So that, the idea of doing that would be terrifying. The fact that I'm 97 pages into a Neverwhere novel right now
is not terrifying. It's that's the book that I'm really looking forward to getting back to. I'm loving it. It's wonderful. All of these characters are still there, and they're still alive, and there are all of these new ones, and, you know, the Marquis is in deep trouble, and Richard is in more trouble than he thinks he is, and it's, and there's all of this stuff that's going to happen that I know that nobody else does. That's just fun. But it's also fun because I'm doing it because I want to. With Good Omens, I guess if I were making it for the fans, I would actually be scared. But I'm not. I'm making it for Terry. And he's not around, which means that I'm kind of making it for me and for an invisible Terry in my head. And it's a weird kind of phenomenon because it's every time I get stuck, it's like, Terry, where are you? When we got stuck on Good Omens, I would throw it over to you and we'd talk and we'd get out of it. And by the same token, every time I do something really clever, it's like, where are you? I want to tell you, I did this clever thing. I fixed this thing. I made it happen. And, you know. But I'm loving Good Omens. It doesn't look like anything anyone else has made. It doesn't feel like anything anyone else has made. I am very much looking forward to it being done. I'm looking forward to retiring from showrunning and going back to being a writer. Amanda did not ever, I think when we took up together and when she married me, she never expected to be married to somebody with a, you know, sort of 9-to-5 job. That was never in the cards, or even a 6 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night job. That also wasn't on the cards. So, you know, so I'm very much looking forward to becoming a retired showrunner.
On that note, I think we should all give a massive round of applause to Neil Gaiman, who's been brilliant.
Thanks for listening to the ILFD podcast. International Literature Festival Dublin is a Dublin City Council initiative kindly supported by the Arts Council.